This is Mike Johnson with the download edition of World Business Report for Wednesday, the 6th of May. This is World Business Report. Hello, I'm Mike Johnson. Brussels unveils a new strategy to boost Europe's digital economy.
If you look at the opportunity for Europe to trade as a single market, both online and offline, it's absolutely massive.
We'll ask if this is an EU challenge to the dominance of US firms like Google. Also today, where did I put that crystal ball? Oh, yes.
Look, far enough in the future, all vehicles will be electric. We'll have a Mars colony probably within 50 years. We will have to grow more food than since the beginning of agriculture.
As we hurtle, apparently, towards the age of future shock, what impact will it have? Also, the currency that came in from the cold, how the rising Chinese yuan is proving a major challenge to Washington's standing on the world stage. And bless my follicles, how grey hair became high fashion.
Yeah, I think I'll just keep dyeing it, actually.
I'm actually looking forward to it. Men can look quite dashing in grey hair.
They're actually paying to go grey. Well, that's mental.
That's all coming up over the next half an hour. Well, it might be the world's biggest trading bloc, but according to Brussels, the European Union is a laggard when it comes to the digital economy. The European Commission has just launched a new strategy designed to break down barriers to online transactions within the EU. Günther Oettinger is Commissioner for the Digital Economy and Society.
Industries, citizens, all of us are going through what we call a digital revolution. We are working on revising a European strategy which will reinforce our digital authority and will give us digital sovereignty, which we do not always have and will make us competitive globally. The digital internal market should be good for citizens and users. It should make the startups and continuing existence of these companies a lot better. It will make it possible for SMEs to have a clear market of opportunities and also create a market for our industry, which will be an important home market in the context of global competition.
That was Günther Oettinger. Well, there'll be a move to harmonise rules on consumer protection and also to end what's known as geo-blocking. That's where online sellers deny access to consumers based on their location. The Commission's also launched an inquiry into how non-EU companies like Google, Amazon, Facebook or eBay handle online trade. Guy Levin runs the Coalition for a Digital Economy, which represents technology entrepreneurs in Europe. What problem is this new strategy designed to solve?
The problem is that startups today can scale up more quickly than ever before. Digital businesses can reach huge numbers of users very, very quickly. But laws and regulations haven't kept pace. Digital companies don't obey national borders, but they're trying to deal with 28 different sets of rules on things like copyright, data protection, consumer rights and so on, which makes scaling up within the EU quite difficult. And so many startups decide it's easier as they get funding to move over to the US, where there's often just one set of rules. So in an ideal world, this strategy announced today is aimed at breaking down those barriers to help boost trade and commerce within the EU.
I suppose the danger is that the result of it all is that actually things get levelled in the wrong direction from your point of view and the company's point of view, and that things get levelled up to the most bureaucratic level.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the big risk. And we have been arguing for a sort of pro-innovation, light-touch, deregulatory approach that's about reducing barriers for digital entrepreneurs, not putting them up.
And in terms of what exactly this strategy involves, this being the European Commission, it isn't simple. I think there's 16 separate initiatives. What one would you highlight as being most interesting?
I think the one that's got the biggest potential risks is around platforms. The Commission has said it wants to investigate the role of platforms, intermediaries and the sharing economy.
Well, what do we mean by platforms? What are we talking
about? So I think what many people in the Commission think by that is the big US tech giants, but I think there are many small startups that both are aspiring to be platforms and marketplaces themselves or are heavily reliant on them. So there's a risk that if you go after the big platforms, you end up hitting the little guy as well.
Right, and when we talk about the big US tech giants, we are obviously talking about the likes of Google, Amazon, eBay. And there is a feeling in the States, isn't there, that this is Fortress Europe coming out here, trying to erect bigger barriers to trade between the EU and the rest of the world. Do you think they're justified to be worried about that?
I think there are many in Europe who do see this through a lens of protectionism and through an anti-US feeling. I think that's completely the wrong attitude. The internet is global. We should be trying to welcome innovation from wherever it comes. And in an ideal world, this strategy should be about reducing barriers to innovation, not trying to put them up around Europe.
The big question, though, is anything actually going to happen? Because you can't, for example, I don't know, harmonise sales tax rates. We know it was value-added tax, VAT, here in the UK. You're not going to get all 28 governments to harmonise VAT overnight, are you?
No, and I think this is going to take time. There are some things the Commission can do itself without legislating or without passing sort of laws, but lots of it is going to require the buy-in from member states. And as we've seen on things like the data protection regulation currently going through, it's been sort of several years since it was proposed and it's still sort of caught in negotiations. So I think watching actually on the timeframe is vital, but it's worth making that effort, because if you can bring down those barriers, that's the only way that Europe is going to succeed, is if you have this single market of 500 million consumers, and that's an amazing opportunity for businesses and it's an amazing opportunity for consumers.
Guy Levin from the Coalition for a Digital Economy. Nicholas Russell is chief executive of a London-based business called We Are Pop-Up. He recently addressed the European Commission on the problems firms face trying to pursue a digital strategy. I started by asking him what We Are Pop-Up actually did.
We Are Pop-Up is basically an Airbnb for retail property. People who have extra retail space list that extra space. So it may be a shelf in a boutique, or it may be part of a boutique itself, or it may be an entire shop. And then small businesses and SME retailers can find space, whether it be for a day or a week or a month or 6 months.
And what issues do you face within your... What are the practical problems a company like yours might face trying to do digital business within the European Union?
Well, what's interesting is, as we're a platform, there's what problems we have as We Are a Pop-Up. And then there's how do our customers expand across Europe? And these are SME retailers. They have enough trouble expanding across the UK, much less entering a foreign country. Yet that's really where the opportunity is.
Are there big barriers? Are there tall barriers, do you think, from one country to another within the European Union when it comes to digital business?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What are they?
One of them is complexity. So, for example, different VAT rates, employment law. You know, I mean, there's every state has its own regulations and laws. These affect our businesses offline, but then they also affect them online. Say you have a pop-up business in London and somebody comes from Italy, visits your business, and then wants to order more product while they're in Italy. Where do you pay VAT? How much VAT do you pay? And I mean, large businesses have teams of people to figure this out, but the small businesses can really struggle.
So how far will this strategy, it's still a long way off, how far would it go towards addressing some of the problems you've just outlined?
It starts to address them, which I think is huge. If you look at the opportunity for Europe to trade as a single market, both online and offline, it's absolutely massive. I mean, if I say something like a pop-up business starting in London, so already we've enabled businesses to start without taking long-term commercial property leases. I mean, that's great. That's the advance that we made in 2013. What if I told you in 2015 or 2016, you could do the same thing if you're a British-based retailer in Rome or Milan or Berlin or Paris, right? Like, what does a transparent market where you can start a business anywhere in Europe and you know what to do, you know what the policies are, you know what the VAT is, you start your pop-up business, you run it for 4 months in the summer in Rome, you capture those online customers, and you continue selling to them when you come back. Now, that hits everything from VAT to data protection to, you know, a number of national issues.
Now, you're American.
Yes.
You know that there have been voices raised in the US that this EU digital strategy is simply Europe being protectionist, trying to pull up the drawbridge, countering the power of big American businesses like Google and Amazon. Is it, do you think?
That's a good question. I think the Americans have had a tremendous opportunity addressing a fragmented European market, right? I think they've made a lot of money because the European market has been so fragmented. I would encourage us...
They've almost exploited that weakness.
I don't think it's even exploiting a weakness. I think it's just a different situation, right? So you think about Uber. Could Uber have launched the same way in a unified Europe, right? Like, we don't know. But the point is, what can we do with one digital European single market? When I spoke to the EU Commission in Riga, what I encouraged them was don't think about American businesses. Let's build the European equivalent here. Let's make a single market big enough so that we can build those tech unicorns and we can build those Googles and Amazons here. And those businesses will then compete on even playing field with the large US businesses.
That was Nicholas Russell, chief executive of We Are Pop-Up in London. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, a new world economic order with the influence of Washington on the wane.
No longer can an American administration working through the World Bank and the IMF say this is how things are going to be.
More on that later. First, let's head to the financial markets, where energy firms have been in the spotlight. As I heard from Chris Beecham at IG Markets, that was down to a rise in oil prices.
Yes, it's been the sort of unknown story of the past 2 months or so. Oil actually now at a high for the year and up over 50% really in the last couple of months. Very strong performance coming through as production and oil rig numbers in the US continue to drop and demand, crucially, starting to rise in the US and China, those two big consumers.
OK, and there's a bit of a global sell-off going on at the moment in government bonds. That's investors offloading these IOUs, which are underwritten by governments, of course. Why is that going on and does it matter?
We're seeing a steady rise in yields as people do abandon bonds, partly because the sheer flood of people rushing to the bond market last year when they expected the ECB to launch its QE programme meant that bonds became very popular. So this is a bit of a reversal. I think it does suggest that people need to be a lot more careful about where bond yields are going, assuming the course are going to keep going down. But actually, that's not proved to be the case. I think it marks a big step change for the market.
That was Chris Beecham. Well, the main share index here in London finished up a tenth of a percent at 6,934. But the Dow at the moment in New York, that's down half a percent at 17,836. Now, colonies on Mars, self-driving electric cars, re-engineered food. How will technology change our lives in the decades ahead? It's certainly bringing us an extraordinary world of innovation, known in the jargon these days as future shock. Many, though, worry about the consequences, especially the toll that the increased use of robots will take on jobs. As Alison van Diggelen, creator and host of the Fresh Dialogues interview series, has been discovering in California.
It was here in Silicon Valley in 2012 the first Model S rolled off the production line at the Tesla factory.
See, the robot is bringing the flat panel into the press. They are in slow motion.
The pioneering car maker Tesla Motors has now produced over 70,000 all-electric cars and is gearing up for the release of the new Model X, a futuristic SUV with Falcon wing doors. This summer, it will also start shipping Tesla energy storage batteries for homes, businesses and utilities. Gilbert Passan leads the Tesla manufacturing team and is proud of the numerous red robots at the factory.
What we do here is really kick-ass. Look around. I mean, does it look to you like a boring, old-fashioned car factory?
Absolutely not.
We're using the latest and greatest in manufacturing techniques.
The production team is so fond of its heavy-lifting robots, they're named after action heroes like Wolverine, Vulcan and Colossus. Venture capitalist Steve Jurvetson drives the first Model S to come off Tesla's production line. He has a reputation for putting his money where his mouth is and backing successful startups like Hotmail, SpaceX and Planet Labs. He's a self-described raging techno-optimist and has a front-row seat on the future of innovation. I asked him what we should expect in the next 50 years.
All vehicles will be electric. We'll have a Mars colony probably within 50 years. We will have to grow more food than since the beginning of agriculture. That will be largely driven by GMOs and a variety of roboticized forms of farming and moving off meat production in the way we think of it, killing animals to get meat. We will grow meat in different ways within 50 years. And that actually has some pretty profound effects on everything from greenhouse gases to everything. In that 50-year horizon, the world is going to look remarkably different than today.
As well as being CEO of Tesla, Elon Musk leads SpaceX, the aerospace company that recently launched its sixth mission to resupply the International Space Station.
Five. Four, three, two, one, and liftoff. The Falcon soars from its perch toward the International Space Station.
But all this is just a warm-up for the ultimate mission, a colony on Mars. Elon Musk told me, "I want to die on Mars, just not on impact." He envisioned a philanthropic mission to Mars to install a greenhouse and jumpstart the space race.
You'd have this great shot of, you know, little greenhouse with little green plants on a red background. I thought that would get people excited.
So you literally imagined a photograph inspiring a new
generation. Yeah, you've got to sort of imagine the money shot, if you will. So this would be the furthest that life's ever traveled, the first life on Mars. And I thought, well, maybe that would result in a bigger budget for NASA, and then we could resume the journey.
Of course, in order to get to Mars, Musk and his team would have to invent a low-cost space rocket. Enter SpaceX.
I mean, being a multiplanetary species, having a colony on Mars and probably the moon, is one of those greatest hits, I think, in human evolution. I mean, up there with the opposable thumb, you know, the neuron and multicellular beings, that's a big step.
These grand visions are all very well, but what will life be like here on planet Earth in 50 years? For now, the tech economy is bringing manufacturing back to the US and Europe, but in the long run, robots will take our jobs. This has huge implications for the world economy, business and public policy. Jurvetson admits he's deeply worried about the growing rich-poor divide that tech innovation is exacerbating.
Imagine the robots of the future. I think it's inevitable the jobs will go away. And I think we just need to prepare for that future and, most importantly, talk about it now so that the transition isn't violent and horrible. 40% unemployment, 80% unemployment. We're going to get there.
That report from Alison van Diggelen. Now, did China achieve its extraordinary economic expansion by cheating? For decades now, angry voices in Washington and beyond have claimed pretty much that. They say that China has kept the value of its currency, the yuan, artificially low to make Chinese exports more competitive. Successive White House administrations have said that has cost American jobs and growth and distorted the global economy. Recently, though, Beijing has been allowing the yuan to rise. And now the International Monetary Fund is believed to be on the verge of declaring the Chinese currency fairly valued. I asked the US economist Owen Stelzer how significant that declaration would be.
It'll have, first of all, a significance in the United States that the critics who are opposing the new trade agreements that President Obama wants will have one less thing that they can complain about, although they won't agree with the IMF determination that the yuan, I think their expression is not undervalued anymore. It's gone up about 30% relative to other currencies in the past 10 years. So that the yuan then could become like the dollar, the euro, and the yen, a reserve currency in which the world will trade. Now, that's already happening. About 25% of China's trade is now in the yuan, and that was in 2009, I think, 0.02%. So the yuan is rising, and when you couple that with the establishment by China of the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank to compete with the World Bank, which is essentially a U.S.-dominated institution, you get what Larry Summers says, that this is the moment the United States lost its role as the underwriter of the global economic system. So this is a really important shift away from America toward China, indicating the loss of American influence because America tried to stop its European allies from joining the new Chinese World Bank and couldn't. Britain joined without even notifying the United States, and then almost all of Europe followed.
And it pulls the rug right out from under American critics of Chinese currency policy in the White House and beyond.
Certainly the White House has been trying to head off the notion that we shouldn't sign these trade agreements because China is a manipulator of its currency. I don't think you'll stifle the critics, but they will have less authority behind their complaint than they've had in the past. And that certainly will help the administration try to get through its trade program.
How then do you think Washington will respond? You said it's a fundamental change in how the global economy is underpinned. Will Washington try and get its influence back, or is this an inevitable drift?
Very little in the policy area is inevitable. I don't believe Washington will do anything to restore its influence because this administration's entire goal has been to reduce America's influence in world affairs by, again, using the administration phrase, leading from behind. Leading from behind has implications of which this economic change is one, of which China's rising military power, its arming its South China Sea with new islands that can accommodate fighter planes. All of that is in the mix of a retreat by America of its presence in the world. Now, that's reversible, but not by this administration.
And what does it mean in practical terms for American businesses? If the Chinese currency has begun to rise again, is life getting easier? Are more American jobs being created because of that? Because that was the counter-argument all along, wasn't it? That American jobs were being destroyed because Beijing was unfairly manipulating the yuan.
economists always say, other things being equal, well, other things aren't equal. The dollar is very strong. The flood of imports into the country that was backed up by the West Coast port strikes is now engulfing the country, which is hurting growth in the American economy. So I would say, at least for the next year, it looks as if we will be hurt by trade. Otherwise, if things had been equal and if the yuan did increase in value and continued to increase in value, that would be helpful to American exporters. But right now, I think things are about where they're going to be, unless the yuan goes up much further, which doesn't seem very likely at the moment. So I think the impact of these changes is long run, is a change in the power of institutions in the world. And no longer can an American administration working through the World Bank and the IMF say this is how things are going to be.
Erwin Stelzer at the Hudson Institute in Washington. Now, once upon a time, going grey was bad. It was damning evidence that you were getting old. Well, not anymore. Grey hair is apparently the latest must-have beauty trend for men and women alike. Amazon says British sales of products designed to actually turn your hair grey rather than disguise any greyness have jumped 83% in the past year. Our reporter Tony Bonsignore has been out and about on the streets of central London gauging opinion on the prospect of going grey.
How do you feel about going grey?
I don't really care. I think I'm going to go grey in the next couple of years, so I don't think it's going to make me look worse.
Yeah, I think I'll just keep dyeing it, actually.
Yeah?
Blonde.
Yeah.
It's just part of life, isn't it? I'd never dye it. You'd look a bit of a fool if it was in the rain and it all started running down your neck, wouldn't it? I'd dye it.
Well, I don't think I would be able to pull off grey hair that well, but if I'm really old, like 50...
That's not really old.
For now, it seems like light years away, but then I think I would rather have grey hair than have black hair because it would just look fake.
I'm actually looking forward to it. Men can look quite dashing in grey hair.
Well, you don't have to wait if you don't want. How would you feel about paying for the privilege, bringing on those grey hairs just a little bit sooner?
I'd probably prefer nature to take its course. I need the wrinkles on my face to match my hair.
Like me.
Exactly.
There's a fashion now, especially here in London, amongst the trendies of people paying to have their hair dyed grey. Would you consider that?
Yes, I think I would.
Why?
It's a trend.
What's the appeal?
Just to be like George.
George Michael?
Clooney.
George Clooney. Is George Clooney the key?
Yeah.
Is he the man that's made grey hair sexy?
Yeah.
But if I was very young, 18, 20, and it was trendy, maybe a soft grey, but then you're young, so it's like with fashion. Yeah. Young can wear old fashion and look young, but the old can't wear fashion, which is not young, because it doesn't look right.
So I'm not going to ask you what's underneath the hat right now. I'm going to ask you first. How do you feel about the years passing and you're turning grey a bit?
Well, I've gone past that. I've turned grey and lost it all. I've shaved all my head now.
If it was a choice, would you ever consider paying to go grey like some of these young trendies are around here?
They're actually paying to go grey.
They're paying to go grey.
Well, that's mental. Well, that's just a fashion thing, isn't it? So it's ridiculous, though. But anyway, fair play to them.
Some thoughts there from Londoners on the inevitable prospect, perhaps, of going grey. Well, Tori Durbridge is a colour technician at the Eastern Regal Hair Salon in Clerkenwell. That's just a few kilometres east of our studios here at Broadcasting House. She told me that she's seeing more and more customers expressing a desire to go grey gracefully and prematurely. I asked her who exactly was leading the trend.
Our salon is very much about on trend and what's on the catwalks and all the celebs have got at the moment. So we are getting quite a lot of it in the salon.
So people walking in and saying, I want to look like, or something like that. Who are they thinking of?
Pictures like Perry Edwards from Little Mix, Kelly Osbourne. I mean, that one was a few years ago, but obviously they're Googling pictures. Pinterest and Instagram, like, is going crazy at the moment. So we've got them bringing in the pictures, which is great. It's great to have something to refer to.
So you have young people coming in saying, look, I want to look grey.
Yeah,
they probably don't say exactly
more silver
that,
than grey, but yeah,
because they think it. Well, it's on trend. It just looks good.
Yeah, it's eye catching and it's quite striking.
And you brought some of your products in. You've got a box here. This is Vibrance Tone on Tone Coloration. I mean, what are we talking about? Just getting this out here. Well, it's a tube.
Yeah.
I mean, what is...
So you mix that with a developer, with peroxide, and it literally just sits on the hair and washes out after 6 weeks.
And is it easy to reverse? I mean, if suddenly people feel grey is not a... Sorry, silver is not a good look. Can you reverse it quickly? Or?
You just need to be very careful again, going from something really white blonde if you want to go back dark or go to a nice caramel colour. It is quite tricky and it's a gradual process, so you need to be 100% sure that that's what you want to do.
There does seem to be a trend for people actually trying to do this at home, doesn't there? If you've got online retailers like Amazon seeing this big increase in sales of this kind of product.
Yeah, I personally wouldn't recommend it. I think a lot of hair salons, they don't tend to recommend doing hair, any sort of hair colour from home.
Do you think it's odd that people are coming in trying to look silver?
No, it's on trend and you get strange colours. Some people turn pink and green and blue. We're also seeing a lot of that at the moment. So it's fashionable and fashion is always slightly different, isn't it?
And do you think it will last? I mean, obviously, people like George Clooney, they've actually been in the public eye for years, haven't they? Do you think this is a keeper as a trend?
For men, I think it is. The whole silver fox thing is very popular at the moment, and if people can get away with not colouring their hair, especially men, if they can get away with not colouring their hair, I don't think they will.
So for a lot of men, it's simply a case of, look, I don't have to bother buying something to disguise my greyness. So
it's
manna from heaven for them.
Yeah, it's great for men. Women, it's a very high-maintenance colour, so... You just have to be 100% sure that that's what you want to do.
Yes, indeed. I was talking there to Tori Durbridge of the Eastern Regal Hair Salon here in London. Well, what do you think? Are you keen to go grey before your time? Would you splash out on some product to turn you into a silver fox? Or maybe the very idea chills you to your roots? Email us at world.business@bbc.co.uk. You can also leave a comment on the BBC Business page on Facebook or tweet us at BBC World Biz. And that's all for this Download World Business Report.
You've been listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. For more news and analysis, download Business Matters, our daily hour-long mix of current affairs and debate, published at breakfast time in Asia and Europe. We debate key trends in the worlds of work, politics, technology and the environment. Find it at bbc.com/podcasts. You can also follow us and get our latest audio at twitter.com/BBC World Biz and talk to us on Facebook at facebook.com/BBC Business.